Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 22nd of September. All things political is what you always hear on Mondays at 1 o'clock, and we have a lot to talk about this hour. A huge march in New York yesterday, as well as many other cities all over the world. As many as 400,000 people, and they were marching to talk about climate change and how serious it is. It was the People's Climate March, and this week world leaders are gathering at the UN for a summit meeting on climate change. This on the heels of last week's announcement. Meteorologists at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced that the months of June, July, and August were the hottest on record for the globe, and 2014 was on track to break the record for the hottest year set in 2010. Will U.S. forces ultimately be needed on the ground to fight ISIS? The president says no. The chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, says maybe. A military-led campaign against Ebola, 3,000 people from the military and $750 million. Voter ID, we'll talk about that. And we will also look at the importance of the Latino vote. In 2014, Latinos displaced non-Hispanic whites as the largest racial ethnic group in the state of California. Texas will make the same transition sometime before 2020. And when that happens, America's two most populous states will be carrying the largest number of electoral college votes with Latino majority states. Our guest this hour has a book that has just been released today. It is Latino America, How America's Most Dynamic Population is Poised to Transform the Politics of the Nation. Professor Matt Barreto is with us. He's a professor of political science at the University of Washington and the co-founder of Latino Decisions, which is a leader in Latino political opinion research. He is has an expertise in Latino public opinion, voting behavior, and race politics in this country, including voter ID laws. He was principal investigator of the American National Election Study Latino Oversample, the first ever oversample of Latino voters, and was also an expert witness in the voter ID trial in Wisconsin. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. A lot to talk about this hour. I haven't even mentioned some of the subjects we'll be discussing and whatever you would like to bring to the table. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Matt Barreto, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. Let's start with the huge demonstrations, not only in New York, but all over the world. The UN Climate Summit is taking place this week. We've been talking about this issue for a long time, but there doesn't seem to be a major effort to reduce carbon emissions. Do massive demonstrations like this make a difference?
Well, you know, it puts the issue back on the agenda, I think, is what the role that the demonstrations and the protests do. There's a lot of research in sociology and political science that suggests this is a very effective way for movements to keep their issue on the agenda. When it comes to the actual follow-through, unfortunately, it's a much murkier picture, especially when you're talking about global issues where other actors are involved. But I would say that when we see these large-scale demonstrations and when we see them coordinated, it does really put attention on this, and it forces policymakers to confront the issue and at least discuss it. So mm-hmm. That's a good first start.
I was watching the news last night, which I do every night, and I was so interested that it wasn't one of the major stories on the news. And I know there have been complaints today that it has been a rather underreported story. Whenever you have that many people descending on a city, you would think it would be a major story.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that front. I think that there has been slightly less coverage than we might expect. It will remain to be seen, if they can sustain some coordinated protests and marches in other cities or in other days. And I think as we get closer to the election, if these groups can continue to sustain some additional protests and marches, they will get back into the spotlight. You know, if you think back to the Occupy movement, the first few weeks that they were there, they got almost no coverage. So sometimes these things take a while to see if they build up.
Mm-hmm. And do you expect any action from the UN meeting this week?
Well, I think, it's always difficult to tell in terms of what the outcomes will be, but I I expect that folks at the UN meeting certainly were paying attention to these protests. They know that they were going on. And I would expect to see some, you know, strong language coming out of that. Whether or not there's action or not is always a troubling point when it comes to international collaborative action, such as the UN and other groups. So I wouldn't be holding my breath for too much action, but I would expect some strong language to come out. I think it is becoming a very important issue and one that the UN and other international bodies are really pushing the United States to confront head on.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Latino America. Your book is just out today, and congratulations on that, sir. It's very nice, I'm sure, for you.
Thank you.
2014, this is really significant. Latinos displacing non-Hispanic whites is the largest racial ethnic group in the state of California. Texas will follow pretty soon. New Mexico already there, and we've got New York, Florida, Arizona, and Nevada, which are rapidly shifting. Tell me, what are the ramifications of that? And let's start with the midterms.
Well, you know, we see the Latino population increasing, you know, across the United States, most notably in those states that you mentioned, in the Southwest as well as Florida. But they're increasing everywhere. We have an analysis in the book where we demonstrate that in every single congressional district in America, the Latino population is larger this year than it was last year, and next year it will be larger yet again. And so what that means is that each successive election, and this midterm is no different, there are more districts, there are more states where the Latino electorate is starting to sneak up and surprise people. And so we've done an analysis of about 27 districts or so, some held by incumbent Republicans, some held by incumbent Democrats, where we expect those outcomes to be very close. And we expect this growing Latino population to significantly influence. So on the House side, there are going to be districts where Latinos influence the outcome, whether it's through a large turnout and support for Democrats, or whether it's through small turnout and an unenthusiastic response, which would definitely benefit Republicans. So Latinos will continue to be influential this year. And a very large point that we make in the book, especially in the demographic section, is that this is a trend that is going to continue for the next few election cycles into the foreseeable future. Latinos will be a larger part of every state, of every congressional district, and politicians and campaigns need to be taking notice.
And what's happened with this vote? You write in the book that these new Americans, the number of people who become of voting age, entered the electorate 2-1 Democratic. In 2012, they voted nearly 3-1 Democratic, but it wasn't always so. Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush both performed significantly better among Latinos. Why?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. One of the important takeaways that I hope people take from this is that about half of Latinos in the United States tell us in surveys that they have voted Republican at some point in the recent past. And you don't have to go back all the way to Reagan. As you mentioned, George W. Bush in 2004 in his reelection campaign, he was able to win close to 40% of Latino voters. And then about another 10% or so have voted for Republican, for governor or U.S. Senate, perhaps Marco Rubio in the case of Florida. And it means that it is an electorate that is evolving, that is up for grabs. I wouldn't read too heavily into the last two Obama cycles. It's just been a very poor field of Republican candidates in the last two cycles, the mistakes made by John McCain, and then, of course, the terrible outreach that Mitt Romney had to Hispanics in 2012. So it certainly is a vote that's up for grabs, and it's a new vote. It's transforming. People are coming into the electorate each year, and they may not have that cemented party identification that other Americans have.
Mm-hmm. Was it a wise choice or not for the president to hold off on immigration reform until after the midterms?
Well, I think this was actually a mistake, not just from the perspective of mobilizing Hispanic voters, but I think in general. I think that when you look at polls, Congress has record low approval rating, and Americans were looking for some sort of action. The argument by the White House and others were that in some southern states like Arkansas and North Carolina, where there are vulnerable Democrats facing tough elections, that those moderate white voters or even conservative white voters just couldn't stomach immigration reform. And I don't think that's the case. I think that, you know, these moderate white voters were very frustrated with Congress's inaction. Poll after poll suggests that a majority of Americans want immigration reform. They want a new system. They don't want to continue living with the status quo. So I think the Democrats actually had an action to use that issue and to run as a party of supporting immigrants, and they missed that opportunity. And so I think the delay is going to make no changes to the status quo, in particular for Hispanic voters. Our polling has suggested that they're quite upset with the delay, that this they think there's just more politics as usual. Obama had publicly stated that he would issue an executive order before the election, and now he's sort of backtracking on that. So in those key districts where Latinos will matter, there could be a mobilization or enthusiasm question mark for the Democrats. They're going to have to work a lot harder now.
Mm-hmm. And do you want to give us any predictions, as we always ask our guests on Mondays, as to the makeup of the Senate after the midterms?
Well, I think that, you know, the state-by-state polling, which is what folks should be looking at, is showing very, very tight races. The general national polling is showing usually better numbers for the Republicans. But in the state-by-state races, it's showing a much closer scenario. Most of the people think the smart money is on the Republicans taking the United States Senate. But I think that if you go state-by-state, the polling right now suggests that Democrats will still hold on to a slim majority in the United States Senate, whether it's with 51 seats or whether it's with only 50 seats and Joe Biden being the tie-breaking vote. And so that's one thing that we need to remember, is that for the informed, you know, sort of consumers, you know, really go state by state, see what each of the state individual polls is showing. Don't just look at the national numbers. And it is true that the national numbers are very strong for Republicans right now.
Let's talk about voter ID for a moment. You were an expert witness in the trial in Wisconsin, and you've also done a survey that looked at discrepancies, and they were significant in terms of possession rates of valid photo IDs for African Americans and Hispanics. First of all, do you imagine that the Seventh, I don't know how closely you're following it now, but that the full appeals court will take up this case before the midterm elections? And then the second question would be, in Wisconsin and other places, just instituting voter ID for this election, what will be the impact?
Yeah, well, certainly there's a compressed schedule right now. The elections are coming up, and people need to be informed of what the rules are going to be, especially as early voting starts to open. And so I think there's an unknown there. I'm not an expert on reading the appellate court and what they're going to do and not do. But we did participate in the federal trial of voter ID of last year, in which the trial court at least set aside the voter ID law and found very clear evidence, not only through the report that I co-authored with Professor Sanchez at New Mexico, but also in the additional database matching evidence that was presented, very strong evidence that Hispanics and African Americans in Wisconsin were significantly disenfranchised by this ruling, by this voter ID law. And we have found that very consistent evidence in national surveys, as well as other state surveys that we've conducted in Pennsylvania, Indiana, and elsewhere, that minorities have lower rates of possession of these valid photo IDs. Somewhere in the range of 10 to 15% of minority voters who are otherwise eligible to vote, in fact, may already be registered. They may not have a driver's license or state ID card. They may be in a situation where they don't own a car and they don't have those sorts of documents. So if implemented fully, this voter ID law could impact minority voters at a much higher rate than it would impact whites.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have other areas to discuss, but we'll start with these and welcome your thoughts. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where you're always welcome to leave your messages. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. He is co-author, Matt Barreto, our guest this hour, of Latino America, How America's Most Dynamic Population is Poised to Transform the Politics of the Nation. The book was just released today. He is a professor of political science at the University of Washington and co-founder of Latino Decisions, a leader in Latino political opinion research. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. And we've looked at the massive protests concerning climate change in New York City and all over the world. Yesterday was an International Day of Action on Climate Change. Do you think that that focuses attention on the part of the delegates who will be at the UN this week to take serious action on this issue? What do you make of the Latino vote and the impact it will have, not only in the midterms, but in the next presidential election? We can talk about that as well, and a number of other issues. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All things political this hour, and let's start our phone calls with Nate in Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I think the protests are a really big issue, but I wanted to ask the guest about a possible Wisconsin voting rights issue. For context, there are two websites, Verify the Recall and Put Wisconsin First, which have a searchable database of anybody that signed a recall petition against a Republican, but not a Democrat, in Wisconsin recently. And this has been, I think, used in the past when the governor rescinded College Guy's appointment. But recently, the Capital Times reported there was a group planning on using one of these websites to challenge people at the polls if they try to vote, and the group specifically said that it will not challenge any Republicans, and it's trying to use the connections to the legal system database in order to determine if they have an excuse to challenge or call the police on somebody if that person would like to vote. And since this seems to be not fighting crime, but picking people because of who they may vote for, I think there is an argument that this is a voting rights issue.
Professor?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very disturbing issue. We've seen that in other states. There's actually a long history, you know, going all the way back to before the Voting Rights Act, of these so-called poll monitors, folks who not only challenge voters' credentials, but use intimidation by other means. It's something that seems to have been lessened, you know, in the last few decades, but now we're starting to see that pop back up. We've seen it in a variety of other states, in Ohio, Florida, New Mexico, over the last few presidential election cycles. And, you know, every voter needs to know that if they are qualified, if they are over the age of 18, a U.S. citizen, eligible to vote, registered to vote, that they have a right to vote, and that the only person that they should be interacting with is the poll worker in the voting booth, in the polling place precinct, and that even worst case scenario, if there is any question, that that voter has a right to ask for and cast a provisional ballot that can be verified later. But it is something that I think you raise an important question as to the extent to which this is going on. It's something that we should all be on the lookout for this election, and other advocacy groups, you know, should be participating in perhaps monitoring the other poll monitors. We just want to make sure, and I think, you know, that everyone would agree with this, that everyone who has a right to vote is given that opportunity to vote, and that people are not discouraged or intimidated in any way on election day.
Anything else, Nate?
Thank you. And I mentioned the article, and I did think it was remarkably partisan that, I mean, if you're a Republican and you might have a wanted by the police issue, they would ignore you, but not if there's a chance you would be voting for a Democrat.
Thank you very much for the call. I have a hard time understanding, number one, why the Republicans have made this a big issue in the last few years, when it doesn't seem to have been in previous years. Number two, most people who look at this, including very nonpartisan election scholars, will say that the only thing that they can see is that this is an attempt to hold down the vote. Do you see it that way? And if so, how can you get away with that?
Well, I think there's been a lot of objective analysis from social scientists and from law professors and others that suggests that, you know, this does appear to be nothing more than an effort to hold down the vote. There are no valid findings of voter fraud, whether it's isolated instances or rampant, that have changed election outcomes. The only voter fraud that seemingly does exist appears to be at the absentee ballot, which none of these efforts of voter ID laws or other voter intimidation measures would counter. So absentee ballot voting continues to go unchanged. There's just absolutely no evidence of voter fraud changing the outcomes of elections in a way that election day voters casting the wrong ballot would be affected by. So the only conclusion then is that there's some sort of effort to limit the people who are voting. And we know there's a very strong association between having the proper credentials or documents, whether it's voter ID or facing voter intimidation, and socioeconomic status and race. I mean, we're really talking about lower income, less educated voters who are going to be affected, whether it's by a voter ID law or by voter intimidation measures. And that's something that, you know, should always be stopped. We should not have certain subgroups of voters who face more hurdles or more intimidation than others. You know, as I said before, if you are eligible to vote, if you're registered and otherwise eligible, you should have the same right to cast your ballot as everyone else. These recent measures, I think, do raise a lot of questions.
Chris in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to ask quickly, and I'll take my answer off the air, but if you think that Latinos who don't have a valid form of identification should be able to vote regardless of immigration status, and also if the welfare state should cover the cost of a license for those minorities that can't afford it.
In the state of Wisconsin, currently there are you have the ability to get a free issued state ID card if you do not have any other form of identification. This has been a requirement in almost every state. This was a requirement issued by the federal courts in the Georgia voter ID law. That is that if you had to pay for the ID, it amounted to a poll tax. You could not force people to have an ID and then force them to pay for that ID if they didn't have one. So there in many states, there are free issued identification cards. One of the biggest questions is whether or not people even have the ability to get that. For example, a large number of people who are otherwise eligible to vote, U.S. citizens and over the age of 18, may not have their original birth certificate or Social Security number or other pieces of what we call underlying documents that are necessary to obtain that. And so it may require lots of extra burdens and hurdles for those folks to go through to get that. I think that in most places, the trend has been that as long as you find an affidavit and affirm that you are over the age of 18, U.S. citizen, and eligible to vote, that you can register to vote with minimal burdens and barriers. And in many places, these voter ID laws seem to be increasing the number of barriers and hurdles that voters have to confront.
And if people want to call in and continue with questions about voter ID, that's fine. We're going to move into a few other subjects here. This has been all over the news, certainly today. The Army veteran who jumped a fence and managed to make it into the White House, he had a knife. And was described, there's a lot of sadness here, as an Army veteran who served in the Iraq War twice, actually, was diagnosed with combat trauma. He had been homeless and living alone in the wild in campgrounds with his two dogs for the past 2 years. Obviously, you can have somebody jumping the fence, but there really are a combination of issues as we look at that story, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, really the strongest angle here is once again, issues related to mental health, mm-hmm. Opportunities for treatment, whether we're talking about veterans or, you know, troubled teenagers. There appears to be a thread there in which people who are confronting mental health issues are not gaining access to the appropriate services to deal with those. And that's a very, very sad part of the story.
Yeah. Somebody did ask the obvious question over the weekend, something I was watching. I said, don't they lock the door to the White House? I mean, you would think it would be, wouldn't you? It would be locked, but it wasn't.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting sort of commentary that came on the Sunday shows yesterday and whatnot about, you know, how far did this guy actually make it and where did he get to? I don't know if they were having an open house or what, but I think that
right.
There were a number of questions that, it appeared that he was captured and subdued, but there are legitimate questions in terms of how far he got and, of course, that was unknown how harmful he was until they apprehended him.
So, yeah.
I'm sure this will create a new debate and perhaps some new policies will come as a result.
I'm sure. Let's talk about ISIS and how we fight them for a moment. There seems to be conflicting statements here when answering the question, will U.S. forces ultimately be needed on the ground to fight ISIS? The president says no. The chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, says maybe they will. Time magazine is reporting today that the president is senior officials in the White House are saying some Americans who fought with ISIS have returned to the United States, according to a senior official. What do you make of all of this? Do you think that we're going to be sending forces on the ground?
Well, you know, I think that the problem that the White House has had on this has been consistency, which you just alluded to in the differing statements. I think they certainly want to deal with this issue. There's no question about that. They've made many, many strong statements. But, you know, this is a problem that plagued the previous White House in the lead up to the 2003 Iraq War. There was not a strong plan for exactly how many troops would be committed and in what stages and what the follow-up plan would be. And I think because of that, because of the way the Iraq War under the George W. Bush administration seemed to just sort of go on forever and not have an exit strategy, my sense is that the current White House under Obama is really trying to think about that. Unfortunately, they have not yet laid out exactly what that strategy will be. Perhaps that's for security reasons or other reasons, but there have been a lot of questions raised by U.S. senators and others as to exactly what the commitment of the United States will be. And part of the answer may be that military folks may disagree on that. They may not actually know. That's always one of the dangers of getting involved in these sorts of entanglements, is that it's not clear what the ground troops will be, and it's not clear what the exit strategy will be, and it's not clear what victory will be defined mm-hmm. as. These are very important lessons that we learned from the Iraq War, and I think we need good answers to those.
Yeah. And as a political scientist who studies all of these issues, can you come up with a definitive answer as to or an informed opinion as to what our commitment should be?
You know, that's I think that's something that's better left for the folks who are in the military who know the four facts on the ground. I'd say, you know, any of us on the outside are just going to be speculating. We don't know exactly how much can be successfully taken out with airstrikes alone. We don't know exactly how many troops ISIS itself has. Even these estimates are ranging wildly. And so this is not a traditional war where you're targeting a country with a published and known army size. You know, this is something that really does rely on a lot of inside classified information. And so I think we have to trust that the military leaders are providing the president and his advisors with the correct information and that they're going to be able to make those assessments. Otherwise, we're just guessing. And as we've seen warfare really change, you know, this is really the new face of warfare, is that there's not a lot of public information as there used to be.
Yeah. Well, talking about another kind of warfare, the president also talked about the military-led campaign against Ebola last week with 3,000 people from the American military and $750 million. What sadness exists in so many countries now in Africa? Does that strike you as a significant contribution to fighting this deadly disease?
You know, it does sort of sound like on the low side in today's budget numbers and the amount of foreign aid that the United States provides and that others provide. Certainly, if it's money that's not currently being provided, $650 million is an important contribution. But I think that, you know, the coverage has been such that it's really devastating and that lots and lots of resources are needed. And you've also seen discussions not just from governments but from foundations and private officials, notably folks like the Gates Foundation, which has had a strong commitment to health issues in Africa. And, you know, I would expect that ultimately that number is going to need to go up if we're going to make a dent in this crisis.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why I was so captivated by this, but their vision of what Scotland should be was, I thought, extremely interesting. I was, you know, here I am on the wee hours of Friday morning watching the internet with all the votes coming in Scotland, which I just found so intriguing, the way they did this and how people were, you know, in their voting places, in their town halls at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning, their time, and they were cheering one side or the other. It was such a display, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, it was sort of gave us a moment, an international moment that was similar to some of the late night election returns we've had here in the
U.S.
In terms of Florida or other sorts of things, as well as a little glimpse of what it was like in some of those 2008 caucuses where you had to show up in person and voice your opinion for your side. And I think it was fascinating. It put a lot of really interesting attention on this. And ultimately, you know, there was not a historic breakaway there. But I think it captivated everybody in terms of seeing this. I'll tell you just one sort of similar position in the Latino community, and there's been a little bit of coverage of this, has been the state of Puerto Rico, the status of Puerto Rico, which, as most folks know, is currently a commonwealth. It's part of the United States, and folks are U.S. citizens, but they don't get a vote for U.S. president, and they're not an actual United State. There's been a little bit of commentary from Puerto Ricans saying, you know, we've had these votes ourselves on status on the island of Puerto Rico. Although Puerto Ricans do not get to just single-handedly decide if over 50% of Puerto Ricans on the island voted to form their own country or change their status, the rest of the United States and the United States Congress would have to approve. And so I think that's one of the things that was so interesting in Scotland, was that all of this was riding on the vote of the people of Scotland, and they had the ability to either stay with the UK or break away. And it was a really fascinating story the last few days.
Yeah, it sure was. We welcome more phone calls for our guest. He is a political science professor at the University of Washington and author of a book just released today, actually, Latino America, How America's Most Dynamic Population is Poised to Transform the Politics of the Nation. And his name, our guest, is Professor Matt Barreto. He is also the co-founder of Latino Decisions, which is a leading public opinion and research firm specializing in issues that are pertinent to the Latino electorate. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at Kay Dunn Show. The story we led with, nobody seems to think is a major story, which I find hard to believe because we've done a lot of shows on global warming. Maybe some of you were in New York yesterday, or perhaps you're on your way home. But that massive demonstration, what does that put in the minds, if anything, of all of those delegates who will be attending the UN summit on climate change this week in New York City? We certainly welcome your thoughts on that. We are talking about voter ID as well and how it will play into the midterm elections. The Latino electorate, which is rapidly, our guest would say, transforming politics in the United States, the vet who jumped the White House fence and got into the White House is people concerned about security issues. On the table, of course, is whether or not there will be American boots on the ground fighting ISIS, with the president saying no and the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying, well, you know, if it comes to that, it'll come to that. We may have to do that. So what about conflicting thoughts there? The military-led campaign against Ebola, we are sending 3,000 people, $750 million. We talked about the Scottish elections last week. I thought it was a really interesting show. So interesting, that's why I was watching the returns. Some of you may have watched those as well, and we welcome your thoughts on what you saw, how they voted. Here's, and again, the number, 800-486-8655. Back with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number. We go to Tony in Middleton next. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Yes, my name's Tony. My wife and I we just arrived back from the People's Climate March in New York City.
Uh-huh.
It truly was a fantastic experience, you know. People are realizing, you know, and many leaders are now starting to realize that global warming, you know, it's the most serious problem that we have facing us in the future. Climate disruption, climate change, the impact, it really has to be addressed. And I know that the UN is talking about it more now than they ever have before. And I know that in the future, here within the U.S., we'll start talking more and more about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it truly needs to have a real focus and relationship to people understanding the impact of what it will have for our children, and more so for our grandchildren in the future if we don't address it.
Mm-hmm.
97% of all client scientists say it's humans that are causing it. CO2 that's being put up into the atmosphere, along with methane that's being put up in the atmosphere, it really needs to be addressed. I happen to be personally involved with an organization that is focused on creating a solution that will aid in the future to reduce the use of carbon fuels and reduce the impact of CO2 in the atmosphere. That particular organization is called the Citizens Client Lobby, and their website is citizensclientlobby.org.
Okay, thank you very much, citizensclientlobby.org, and thanks for calling us upon your return from that march. It is such a significant issue. Let's talk about how the world decides to do something about an issue, if we could for a moment, Professor Barreto.
Sure.
Because obviously we've known about this issue for a long time, but what is it that makes it so difficult to switch our reliance on fossil fuels, to cap the emissions, to do this as a planet?
Well, of course, you know, we've got a very, very long institutional memory here and setup that is tied to fossil fuels. We don't have all sorts of alternatives that are already in the market at the same rate. Yes, there are alternatives being developed every day, but we've got, you know, 100 years of history of industrialization tied to the use of fossil
yes.
fuels. And so it makes it difficult to break out of that, whether it's politically or economically or otherwise. And so I think as we develop more alternatives and those alternatives are able to compete on the market and provide reliable and efficient ways to serve energy to our houses, to our cars, elsewhere, I think you will start to see a dramatic change. And it seems like we're getting closer to that with more development and more market consumption of alternative energies. But, you know, it's just very hard to break away from coal and oil and these things that have such strong holds in the U.S. marketplace.
Mm-hmm. We just received your book, and I know that you look at Latino America and thoughts about the environment as well as other issues. Do you want to say a few words about that?
Well, certainly. It's an issue that we do cover in the book. We have a chapter devoted entirely to Hispanic attitudes towards environmental politics and policy. And one of the things that we've been finding lately in our research is that aside from the issue of immigration, the issue of the environment, whether it's carbon pollution, climate change, or the conservation of natural resources, this ranks as one of the highest issues of concern to Latinos across the United States, whether it's because we have a very urban population that is really struggling to deal with issues of smog and other carbon pollution, or whether it's due to families back home in Latin America who are facing the challenges of hurricanes and severe weather as well. This is an issue that really ranks high among Latinos, and Latinos have been very involved in the climate debate and in climate change efforts. And so we're expecting to see more and more collaboration and more involvement by Latinos in the environmental movement in the United States, particularly on the climate change issue. And as that Hispanic population gets more involved in politics and as politicians are paying more attention to Latinos, we expect, yes, the immigration issue will get mentioned and will get lots of attention. But I think you're going to be seeing a lot more action by Latino politicians and activists on the climate issue in the coming years.
Thanks, Tony, for your call. Michelle in Stevens Point, hi.
Hello, Kathleen, and thank you for your program. It's always wonderful.
Thanks, Michelle.
I am calling to ditto what Tony said earlier and add some information. At this point, I'll be in a meeting tonight with the University of Wisconsin students who are part of 350.org, such an important international worldwide organization, and about 15 of those UW students are on their way back from the climate march. And so the young ones are cramped in cars and buses and coming back, and we are anxious to hear their report. But I want to make a pitch for people who maybe feel that they are unable to be involved at an action level. That's not the case in Wisconsin. The Citizens Climate Lobby, which Tony mentioned, and I want that second word is climate. Okay, so citizensclimatelobby.org is the website, is growing by leaps and bounds in the state of Wisconsin. We have so many chapters, and I'm in the Central Wisconsin chapter. There is also the organization 350 that is really growing here in Stevens Point. But we are deeply concerned, and we know that citizen action will help to get that political will for legislation. So these groups are working for legislation all the time, writing to their editors, letters to their editors, doing op-eds throughout our state. I think the fact that we haven't heard much from yesterday, the first time that I've seen the climate lobby march on the national news, it was covered, but probably not in the depth that it can be covered.
Right. Well,
so I hope people don't feel that this is a moot point and that, you know, we've turned away from this. More than ever, we're on it. And citizens can join. And citizen action is needed. I think that we need to pressure for legislation.
Thank you very much for the call. No, I was just wondering why the press didn't cover it more fully, because it was a huge, huge number of people everywhere. And everybody knew it was going to happen, too. So you would think the cameras would have been rolling. Thank you very much, Michelle, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. And speaking of issues that make their way to a lot of coverage and then they disappear, I'd like to ask you, Professor Barreto, about the number of young people, children, many of them, who are apprehended along the border, making that long, arduous, dangerous journey from Central American countries to come here. Are there still all kinds of young people being held in detention centers, or what's going on with that story?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. There are less people being apprehended at the border or intercepted at the border today. Those numbers are certainly lower, but there continue to be thousands of people who are in U.S. detention centers. Many of them are children without any guardians or representatives. And there has been a significant movement from the immigrant rights advocacy groups to really, you know, provide these minors with legal counsel and to give them an immigration hearing. They're entitled to an immigration hearing if they're seeking asylum or refugee status, and many of them have not been awarded that. They have been held, not released on bail or bond, and others have been immediately deported back to their countries of origin. So it continues to be a crisis, not necessarily in terms of the mounting numbers that are being apprehended, but there are still thousands who are in our detention centers and need to have their immigration hearings and trials move forward so that they can get resolution to their cases.
Mm-hmm. So what do we need to do to accomplish that? We need more money to have more trials, more judges, more trials going on, or what?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. There also needs to be some more political willpower. You've had, again, conflicting sort of statements coming out of the White House. Vice President Biden has asked for more legal aid and representation for these folks so that they can have their day in court. At the same time, the Department of Justice has been pushing back and not wanting to provide as much resources to these folks. They say they're not entitled to a legal representative and that they just need to be set for deportation. So, you know, there has been a call on lawyers and civil rights attorneys and immigration attorneys to get involved and to try to help. But certainly their own budgets and resources are stretched thin. It is the sort of thing where we just need to have more pressure put, I think, on the immigration system to say, look, what we have right now is not working well. This is just more evidence that we are in need of reform. We need to have a solution. When thousands of children show up, we can't just leave them sitting in a detention center or a jail forever. At the same time, we can't just immediately put them on an airplane and send them back home. We should hear their case, especially if they're seeking refugee status or asylum because of political violence in their home country.
Yeah. Camille is our next caller in New Berlin. Hi, Camille.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that all these marches are fine and good, But if we took that same amount of energy and effort to organize and transport people and use them to work on election campaigns to put in power people who will effectively make the changes as necessary, we would be in a much better place. We aren't going to change anything until we change who's in power. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Professor, you want to respond?
Well, yeah, I think this gets back to an earlier call or comment we had about those folks who are putting a lot of effort and energy into poll monitoring and what some people might call voter intimidation. It is true that there's been millions of dollars spent lobbying for the passage of voter identification laws and then organizing these so-called poll monitors. And I think a lot of people would agree with that comment that those efforts could be better placed on educating voters, helping voters get the proper credentials they need, or in trying to get those voters out to the polls. And hopefully we'll continue to see more of that. Groups are growing who oppose these voter identification laws and other voter intimidation measures. And I think you're going to start seeing a pretty significant divide on this as more states start to implement these really regressive voting measures. We're going to start to see more activity around this issue, I think.
Dennis in Wautoma. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Dennis.
Hi there. Last week I watched that fantastic seven-part series on the Roosevelt.
Oh, so did I.
And I couldn't help noticing at one point they were talking about how Mrs. Roosevelt was so active and engaged with the African-American community and her efforts, and that they were redoubtable and endless. Her efforts to try to end segregation and end discrimination ultimately did push her husband and slowly the government in those directions, and they credited her and him with the beginning of the change in the thinking of black Americans to where they went from being Republicans to Democrats. And as I look at what's happening now with the way the Republican Party is just so anti-immigrant, and you're beginning to see just a whole mind shift on the part of Hispanics who were very much linked with the Republicans, if any party at all, 12 or 15 years ago, 20 years ago, moving in the direction of the Democrats. Now, are we seeing a seismic shift in voter sympathy or voter thinking with the Hispanics in the same way that the African Americans did, and for some of the same reasons?
Thank you, Dennis, for your call. Professor Brito.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we're seeing right now. Some academics have been collecting a lot of data on this over the years and are really calling it what we call a partisan movement. The Hispanic used to be more distributed equally. It had always trended more Democratic, but Republicans were able to get into the high 30s and even the low 40s in statewide elections, depending on the candidates. And right now, if you just take the last two elections, the 08 and the 12 election, you see significant movement into the Democratic Party and significant movement away from the Republican Party. So it's not just that Hispanics were enamored with the 08 Obama campaign. It's that the Republicans that have come onto the field since then, in the 2012 primaries and then especially the Romney candidacy, really did propel and push Hispanic voters away. The Republican Party did not position itself as being very welcoming. And I think if that continues, if that trend continues, they could actually do even worse than Mitt Romney did. We could see the Hispanic votes start to look more like the African-American vote, which would be very, very bad news for the Republicans in the future.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your call, Dennis. And unfortunately, I'm sorry we left some people on hold, but we're plumb out of time. Congratulations again on the book. And Professor Barreto, I hope you'll join us again. Thoroughly enjoyed the hour.
Sure thing. It was my pleasure. I'll be back anytime.
Thank you. Professor Matt Barreto, and his book has just been released today, actually, Latino America, How America's Most Dynamic Population is Poised to Transform the Politics of America. He's a political science professor at Washington University, and he is also the co-founder of Latino Decisions, a leader in Latino political opinion research. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Scott Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up. from National Public Radio, and we'll talk about the number of new mothers who are unmarried and what that means, hour two of our show.